We are joined by one of the best-known political commentators in America today. Chris Matthews is a proud native of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. He wears his Pennsylvania roots on his sleeve and even contemplated running for the United States Senate from Pennsylvania in 2008, as I recall. For years, he was host of Hardball on MSNBC. Every night on MSNBC at 7 o'clock, you could hear Let's Play Hardball. He now can be found on Substack with Hardball with Chris Matthews. Most people know about your time as a congressional staffer on Capitol Hill, as a speechwriter for Jimmy Carter, as chief of staff to Speaker Tip O'Neill. In preparing for this interview, I learned a couple of things I didn't know about you, Chris. One was that when you first came to D.C., you were a Capitol Hill policeman. It's hard to picture you in a uniform. And two,
I look like Marty Milner.
and two, that though I always pegged you as sort of a Bobby Kennedy liberal, you like to tell people I'm more conservative than you think I am, and that you even voted for George W. Bush for president in the year 2000.
That was a mistake.
And you can fact check me on that, but
it's a mistake.
That's a mistake.
Yeah.
It was a mistaken vote or a mistaken fact?
Well, it's a fact, and you had your all your facts are right. I voted for him because I thought when he said I want a humble foreign policy, I listened. I made the mistake of listening to a politician. I'm sorry, he didn't give us a humble policy. He gave us a neocon, go to hell, crazy foreign policy of go to war over with Iraq and with John Bolton and old Scooter Libby and that whole crowd.
Oh, you mean as opposed to our
He
current
went with the
president?
bad guys.
Okay.
Now the new guys are worse than the bad guys, which is pretty rough.
So before I ask you my first question, I got to tell my favorite Chris Matthews story, which I think you've heard before. In January 2016, I was in the cabinet as Secretary of DHS, and I got picked to be the designated survivor during the president's State of the Union address in 2016.
Yeah.
So I go to the undisclosed location, and I'm thinking that this is top secret, that I'm the designated survivor, the location is top secret, et cetera, et cetera. I get there, it's not nearly as exciting as people think it is, and I turn on the television to watch State of the Union. I turn on MSNBC, and I'm watching Hardball with Chris Matthews, sitting there in my undisclosed secret location, and I'm watching you warm up for the State of the Union, and you pick up this piece of paper and you say, we've just been handed a bulletin here. Jay Johnson is the designated survivor this evening. And I fell out of my chair as if I thought this was supposed to be a big secret. And you had one of the best lines I've ever heard. Gee, that makes sense because no presidency named Johnson begins well. Anyway, Chris, welcome to WBGO.
Thank you.
I want to note that this interview is pre-taped on Monday, April 6th. Given the pace of world events, I think it's important to note that. Chris, when I talk to people on this show, I like to try to rise above the day-to-day politics of the moment. Yesterday, I was at NBC Studios in Washington getting ready to go on Meet the Press. I was handed a statement from our president. Quote, Tuesday will be power plant day and bridge day, all wrapped up in one in Iran. There will be nothing like it. Open the effing strait, you crazy bastards, or you'll be living in hell. Just watch. Praise be to Allah, President Donald J. Trump. He managed to offend everybody from Bernie Sanders to Marjorie Taylor Greene with this statement. And I got to tell you, when I looked at this statement, I thought to myself, if this were 1966 in the depths of the Vietnam War, and you told me that the President of the United States had issued such a statement, or 1973 when it was Richard Nixon, if he had issued such a statement, we'd all say, where's the 25th Amendment? He's lost it. But this is the president we have now. I worry that this is becoming the new normal. He's engaged in an illegal war in Iran, in my judgment. He's engaged in extrajudicial killings on the high seas without congressional authorization. His tariff policy was determined by the Supreme Court to be in excess of his legal authority. I could go on and on and on. He's literally taken a wrecking ball to the White House. And my question to you is someone who I consider an expert in this political space. Why did America elect this man president? Not once, but twice. Why did we elect such a person?
Well, I like it. Let me just draw some comparisons. Barack Obama, I've supported him from the beginning. I thought he'd be a great candidate, and he was a great president. And I thought I wish he was still around. But I think his human understanding of the presidency was real and appropriate. He used good language. His family life was excellent. He took care of his kids. He protected them. He was obviously very faithful to his wife. All those things are what we sort of would like to see in our president. Trump is the opposite. I mean, Trump's behavior is awful. His statements on the media, what he has said again this weekend, when he said it seems to be purposely awful. And not everybody's Catholic, obviously, but the Pope said warriors who pray for war will not be listened to by God, which I think is a somewhat outrageous statement in itself. But then Hegseth came out and started quoting the war we're fighting with Iran and citing Jesus Christ as his sort of motto, his champion. What? People have talked about providence and generalized language about a deity, but they've never actually cited a particular one in our spectrum of religions. And to say this is a battle for Jesus, just to stick it back to the Pope. And then Trump's behavior and his language against the Muslim community. There are a lot of Muslims in the United States who are loyal as hell. What's he saying something like that for? And you crazies, what's my name? I mean, he's the crazy one. And I wonder about the guy. He's overweight. He's behaving oddly. His behavior doesn't seem to be okay. Now, part of the problem is he has no education. I hate to play the liberal card here that we're smarter than the conservatives, because that's not always true. But there's an educational factor here. This guy wasn't raised during the Suez Crisis, which he was. He should remember the Suez Crisis in 56, where Israel, Britain, and France tried to take back the Suez Canal. And finally, wait a minute, that's not NATO. And General Eisenhower, who was Supreme Commander of NATO, said, "No, you're not going to fight this war. This war is over." And all of a sudden, Anthony Eden, the Prime Minister of Britain, is out of office. After 15, 20 years of waiting for Churchill, he had his show and he's gone. It's a disaster. Why didn't Trump understand you don't go it alone without the help of NATO? You don't go in there because you can immediately expect them to say, "Well, we weren't part of the takeoff. We're not going to be part of the landing. And we're not going to go in there and send our ships through the strait to save your butt. You did this. You didn't even call us up and say, 'Guess what? I'm going to war with Iran. And I made it in a 3-hour deal with Bibi Netanyahu. And I never even asked you.'" The French, the British, the Canadians, the Australians, everybody in NATO, not Australia, everybody's in NATO, and they don't matter. He told the Danes, "I'm going to take your country, I'm going to take Greenland away from you." Why would you say that to the most patriotic, most pro-American country in NATO, where they celebrate the 4th of July every year? I'm sorry. Why do you? Because he doesn't know anything. He has no sense of history. He doesn't understand there was a Cold War. There's an understanding that maybe Russia may look at things differently than us. They might be our bête noir out there. He doesn't know that. He's out there sending J.D. Vance over to help Orban this week to get him. Well, he's not going to get reelected, but he might be up to something.
Yeah.
Orban, that's basically
And
helping
those who
Russia.
don't know history are bound to repeat it.
And how about the Russian uprising against Russia? That's what we all wrote at my age. I'm the same age as Trump, and I rooted for Hungary. Who did he root for? Russia? The Warsaw Pact?
Right.
Maybe if you just take statistics in business school, I'm going to knock business school right now. It's not a full education. If all you study is business, you might make a lot of money, but you're not fully educated. You
I
just
got news for you. Law school is not a full legal education either,
don't.
right?
Well,
So, but
I
Chris,
don't
the
feel he has
question is,
any.
why
I
did
don't think
we,
his
why
parents
did,
ever talked to him and said, "Yeah, we had a we." You probably had the same thing. I had a dinner table conversation with my dad every night, and he would say, "Where'd you hear that? Who told you that?" Which is a great line, pretty. So it sounds like a Trumpy line, but "Where'd you hear that?" Which is not a bad line. "Where'd you hear that?" Not have to tell him somebody told him, or I heard it somewhere. But we studied these things at home. We found world events. He didn't. He
So
doesn't
the
know anything. And Hegseth, who's these guys aren't exactly, Henry Kissinger she's asking advice from. I mean, who's he asking advice from? And General Kane seems like a nice professional fellow, but I don't think you can ask him geopolitical advice. I don't think it's on the table for him.
Well,
And
I
I
was
think the
my
enemy.
model of a Secretary of Defense was Bob Gates when I was the General Counsel
He
of
was good.
DOD. So we've come a long way. But Chris, my question is, we elected this guy twice. Why did we do that? We knew what we were getting the second time around. Why didn't we
Because
do
of
this?
hatred. Because of hatred. He hates the people that the voters hate. You ask yourself, okay, if you're a Democrat and you say, who don't you like? We probably would say big business. If you're Bernie and you're on the left, is I don't like billionaires and millionaires. Okay, that's Bernie. But if it's generally, you don't like big corporations because you think they're calling the shots. If you're a Trumpy, who don't you like? I don't like liberals. I don't like them. I don't like bureaucrats. I don't like liberals. I don't like government people. I don't like the deep state. I don't like them. I don't like the cut of their jib. I don't like who they are. And in some instances, I've been at dinner parties in Washington. I know you've been there, where all the people do is talk against the Trumpies. So I think they know that people look down at them. And probably, you think you're better than me? That's the attitude. You think you're better than me? I think that's what Trump plays to in his rallies, certainly. And he knows who those people are because, in a weird way, he's picked up on the grievance of rural white people, generally, and he's picked up on their grievance. So he's living over in Queens and he's angry at the elitists of Manhattan, and he's secretly likes to read the New York Times because he gets the information there. But he doesn't like the New York Times. He doesn't like la-di-da liberals. He doesn't. And he figures the guy out in the country, the guy who's driving a truck or the guy's hauling whatever, he says that guy likes, and it's true. I've been around Pennsylvania. You say I'm a Pennsylvania guy. You go out in Adams County, these southwestern counties, Washington County, they're all Trumpies, all of them. There's nothing going on in town. There's no Trump. Remember in the 50s, there used to be things called gift shops. When you go to a small town, it'd be like little local stores that'd be one for gifts to give gifts to your somebody in the family. There's nothing there like that. There's a Walmart somewhere out of town. There's no local town. There's no local newspaper. There's no conversation. There's no what do you hear? What's happened with you? Anything new? Oh, somebody just having a baby. Oh, somebody's getting divorced, blah. But that conversation is not there anymore. It's just anger. It's anger against Joe Biden of all people. Okay, pretty hard guy to be angry at Joe Biden, but they are angry at still. And Trump still pushes that whistle. He blows that whistle every once in a while. Every 10 or 15 paragraphs, he says, and it's all Joe Biden's fault. And it seems to work with them. But it's hatred. Do you think they like Rahm Emanuel? Not Rahm. I should be careful here. Ron Klayman, or these people in the White House, they don't like the Carter. They probably didn't like the Carter people either. But the Carter people are a lot more humble, a lot humbler than the liberal crowd these days. So we never
Is
thought
this,
part of any.
Chris, is this kind of presidency, this kind of style, this kind of policy, is this the new normal? Or in 28,
It's
can
about
we look
anger
forward to
and
something
grievance.
radically different?
Grievance, and on the Democratic side, it's superiority, and we're superior to them, and they hear that in the columns. If they read a column, or they listen to MS, or they listen to CNN, they hear that condescension. They may hear it on NPR, PBS. They hear it. In the it's in the voice, the people that talk like they're professors, they have a certain inflection in their voice, which says, I was educated and you didn't get educated. I this is a two-way. I mean, I am on the liberal side of things, the moderate liberal side of things, but I really think it's a cultural thing, that it isn't about economics right now. The gas prices across the street are about, for premiums, like over $6, and I don't think it's affected them. I think when I'm out with my friends and my relatives, my family's mixture. It's a mixture. I don't have a group of celebrity liberals around me. I have four brothers and two are Trumpies, and one didn't like the war with Zelensky. He supported Ukraine, But he's back with Trump again. And the other two are arch, one's a real arch liberal and one's a moderate anti-Trump Republican. I asked all my brothers, how would dad have voted? And they all agreed dad would have voted for Trump. So I don't know. I try to, Jay, if you've listened to me, I think you know, I try to be a journalist. I try to understand. If I had to explain America today, I'd say about grievance.
A lot of people, when I put this question to them, say it has a lot to do with the perceived direction of our country, that this generation does not see a brighter future for the next generation, for their kids. They're pessimistic, they're upset, they're angry. I think what you said has a lot to do with it also, that it's cultural. But I know you'll identify with this. There was a point in time, I go back to say Bobby Kennedy. There was a point in time when the Democratic Party was, yes, it was the elite, but it was also blue collar, working class in the factories.
Yeah.
How did that coalition fall apart?
I think they sensed what I said, that they sense a condescension by well-educated people. You know, getting to go to college, you know, whatever level of college it is, whether it's one of the Ivies or one of the great state universities, Catholic schools, it's a gift. It's something you got from your parents, in most cases, your parents who struggled. May have a couple jobs to pay your tuition bill. These tuition bills today are incredible. I mean, it's hard to, Holy Cross, which I love going to school up in Worcester, was like 2,000 a year. And my father paid half of it and I borrowed the rest. It was 3% interest, 3%. And you could pay it off when you got around to it, basically. That's what the deal was. And today it's, I think my daughter-in-law still owes a lot of money for law school. And she's a great lawyer, I think. And but they owe money lo much longer than we ever owed it, and that's different. And now, a person who's in a working class family, a lot of them don't even think about college. Never comes up. You don't have a conversation about whether you go to college or not. You graduate from high school, you probably get married when you're 19, and you go work. Go to work, and going to work today can mean a good income. It's not. A, you're never going to be an exponential tech operator or genius. You're not going to make the big money, but you can make a decent income. And but they don't. The labor unions aren't what they used to be. I think that, and I'm not sure how much enthusiasm. I think there's one African American international leader from the Football League or something, NFL. I don't know who it is, but there's not a lot of ex. There's no. You watch. Just talk TV for a minute. Sunday, Meet the Press, Face the Nation, the Channel 7 one this week. Nobody from labor ever shows up. I'm sorry. Where are your leaders? How come you don't have George Meany on the show? I'm sorry, go old, but we'll go way back. But why don't you ever have a labor leader on? Why aren't any of your leaders ability have the ability to talk like you and I are talking? Why can't labor talk? And they have a good case to make on minimum wage and things like that, and working rights and all kinds of things. They're working hard and they're highly skilled because look at the productivity rates in the country. I'm telling you, why aren't they on television? Why aren't they part of the
I don't
conversation?
know. What's the answer to that
Well,
question?
my aunt, I'll tell you, when back when I was with Senator Muskie back in the old days, George Meany would come in and the Republicans would run over to light a cigar. That's how much times have changed. The Republicans were trying to light a cigar. And by the way, everybody smoked in those days. But you had labor like Jerry Wirth and people, the auto workers, all these top, the brothers, there were serious political discussions. People actually came out and argued, well, on behalf of labor, this is what we think. And they would talk generally about the economy. They would be big people about, so labor was represented. It's not anymore.
What do you think the
That's a big
next?
question. Just to ask a labor leader, where the hell are you? And why aren't you in this debate over the gas prices right now, which affects every industry? Diesel
Of
prices. I have a relative
course.
that said, my truck's parked out front now. With these diesel prices, it's not going to move. Okay? That's how profound this economic reality of the Iran war is.
So, what do you think our politics looks like in the next 2.5 years?
I'm right now, I admit, it's always dangerous to tell what you think. I'm for Gavin Newsom because he can talk at Trump's level. Now, maybe that may be appropriate in 2 years, but the ability to elevate yourself is key in politics. If you can't elevate your being and stop talking about like DeSantis, who was so big and important 2 or 3 years ago, he died because he couldn't elevate. He's talking about the
Yeah.
people of Florida. If Josh Shapiro says one more statement about the people of Pennsylvania or Pritzker about the people, stop talking like a local yokel. You have got, if you're on national television, be national. Stop looking around for votes because that's all you're doing. You have to say, well, the people in Pennsylvania, oh, nobody, they all know where you're from. Stop it. If you want to talk to Trump, be national. Talk about his grabbing of every title in Washington, naming airports after himself and the Kennedy Center and all this billion, all this braggadocio. And take him on and make fun of him being fat. I mean, I wouldn't mind anything goes these days. Go after him personally. That tie of his that goes down to his legs. What kind of tie do you put on it? You go, what is it, 4 feet long? What is that about? It's some kind of ridiculous statement he's making. But you got to get in the ditch with him a little bit. And I mean, I like some of these people. I think I like Whitmer. I think she's good. I think I go back to Gavin. I like Rahm Emanuel because he's tough. He talks about education, not teachers' unions, education, different subject.
Right.
And I think what I'd like to see is a Democrat to come on television and say, I know the Democratic Party chairman, Ken Martin, has refused to release it, but I'll give you the autopsy why we lost in 24. We opened the border for 8 million people to come swarming into the country from China and the Far East, everywhere else. We let them do it. We let them do it because we're pandering to the Hispanic caucus, I guess. That's all I can think of what we're doing. We opened the border. We couldn't give a straight answer about men playing women's sports. Come up with it. Do it by each sport should decide it on its own. I'm going to treat everybody well, but really, maybe the individual sports have to make those decisions, like the Olympics. They're making the decision. People have to make up this decision, but they have to do it in a conscious way, and stop being all weird about it and taking 24, 80 positions all the time. I mean, I think the border closing has been popular. What's been unpopular is the treatment of people as individuals in Minnesota. And I would say to the Democrats, admit you didn't do it. Just say, you know, we opened that border. I don't know why Biden did it. I hold him responsible, but he did it. And his people around him, I named the names, Michael, what's his name? Donlan and Ricchetti and all the guys in the White House who all covered up for what's his name? Joe Biden's getting older. They would never admit it, but when also the pandering that went on. And I think the pandering has ended. I think the Israel situation, thanks to Bibi, I think that automatic Democratic Party support for Israel is over. That automatic
Yeah.
support. I think the Democrats have got to say, he had a regional situation in Israel. We are not a regional power. We are a global power. We did not have to get into a war for regional interests. Israel had a regional problem with Iran. Fair enough. It was clear as bell. We didn't. We didn't. We didn't. In North America, we were not challenged by Iran. In NATO, we were not challenged by Iran. This is a regional struggle we have been led into by Bibi Netanyahu and Dermer and these people around him. They figured out Trump and how to work him. They sit for days and weeks figuring how to work Trump. And they figured out how to do it. They talked him into the
Right.
war.
We do in government, we do analysis, psychological analysis of other world leaders before we sit down with them. And I'm quite sure the same is true in reverse.
Ron Dermer, he's apparently an expert on those guys and what Bibi does with Trump and how he.
Yeah. Let me
But the
you know,
fact
Chief
that
was
going into this war without our allies is insane.
Yeah.
Now we've called on the allies to help us. Just run your shipping through the Strait of Hormuz. All right. Thank you. No, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah. You were chief of staff to Speaker Tip O'Neill back in the 70s, I think. And it's legendary that Tip O'Neill had a great relationship with Ronald Reagan. He
Well,
was
it was, let
Republican,
me tell you what
opposite
it was
party.
like. I just want to correct that a little bit. They didn't like each other that much. I mean,
Really?
they fought in the back room, but they would fight with the cameras off. They would actually go in the back room of the White House and argue, like really get angry at each other, because Reagan was a conservative and Tip was a liberal, and Tip had to deal with people for years, for 50 years, dealing with people's constituent problems and family matters, all kinds of problems and economic problems. And he knew them, and Reagan had spent his life fighting with the other actors for better parts in Hollywood. And they had different experiences, but whenever it came to a serious issue like Social Security, they dealt. They made the deals. They were professionals. When it came to Gorbachev, Tip said to Gorbachev, and he said, "We only got one president. His name's Ronald Reagan. Don't come to Congress. You go to the
Right.
president." And number two, he wants to get rid of nuclear weapons in the worst way. He really wants to do it. And you know, when Tip left, he had Reagan and Bob Hope, and everybody came to his big goodbye party. And Reagan would kid, "You want to be ambassador to Ireland? You got it." He would do anything to get him out of the way. But
Right.
Tip liked the old Reagan Irish accent, the Hollywood version of Irish. You know what I mean? It was like
Yes.
almost like a play on who you where you come from. Tip was the real local Irish guy. I mean, he knew all the stories and the old lore and everything, and he was part of that tribe, I guess. I mean, I am too. I mean, he was very nice to me. I got to tell you that. For 6 years, I worked with him, and I made some good mistakes. Good mistakes. And I get credit for saying I one time a magazine wrote how I told him what to say. I said, "That's not true. No, I could write
Right.
stuff for him when he told me he wanted me to do it." And everything he did, I made all the decisions, obviously. He won 50 straight elections. He was a pal.
So, Chris,
But I
in
also
your
didn't like dislike Reagan. I grew up with good GE theater. I mean, I was watching that Sunday night at 9, and
yeah.
he was a popular figure in my life, really.
Chris, what in your observation, in your lifetime, what was the single finest act of presidential leadership that you observed?
Let me, that's great. That's a great question.
While you're thinking, I'll give you one.
I think,
Go ahead.
look, the thing people tell, and honestly tell people how 9/11 affected their lives. You know?
Right.
I mean, I gave you speeches about the Friendly Sons of St. Patrick and all, and up in New York, and I do admire the Irish guys that 125 of them died in the tower. They raced there from wherever they lived. They got to that tower to do their job. And the thing that affected my life most outside of my family was with John Kennedy being killed. And when John Kennedy was killed, I think the world stopped. And then there was a new world after that was created. I do think it's something that was going on. And I knew the flaws in Kennedy. I didn't see it imperfect. But I thought his handling of the Cuban Missile Crisis was astounding. He and Bobby, they did it together.
Right.
Books about both of doing it together. And Macmillan, the Prime Minister of Britain, said it was the two great men that did that. And to understand how they had to be deceitful about it, they had to tell the Russians that we're going to pull our missiles out of Turkey. But also, it turns out Italy as well. We took some missiles out of Italy too, as a way of peacekeeping, to avoid doing what the military wanted to do, go in there and kill 60,000 Russians. I mean, if he had done that, and he was thinking all the time, if I go into Cuba during the Cuban Missile Crisis, Russia will move on West Berlin. The Warsaw Pact country way outnumbers our troops in West Berlin. They can move in there, and within a half hour, we got to decide whether to push tactical nuclear weapons or not. I mean, really, that's how close it came. That it wouldn't be
Yeah.
Cuba, it would be Berlin. And if I were Trump today, I'd be thinking, okay, we're going to use up all our Tomahawks, we're going to use all our missiles, we're going to use all our men, our most of the men in the war front. We're going to send 50,000 troops over to Iran. What are they thinking about in Taiwan? What's President Xi thinking? You know, this is what happened when the I mentioned this before, the Suez Crisis of 56. Well, that happened at the same time the Hungarians were fighting for their country against Russia. One affects another, and you have to be so careful. And
Right.
sending J.D. Vance over to help Orban in his election, next week, this Saturday, we're aiding the enemy. Orban is a Russia, he's with Russia. They're on the other side. Why are we helping the other side? And why are we sending missiles from Poland or stuff down to the Middle East? Why are we fighting this other war? I've been reading this great book about what Germans were thinking during the World War II, and the people, hard to believe it, the people were scared as the war widened. It went from just knocking off the French and the Lola countries, but Scandinavian countries, but when all of a sudden they confronted Russia, and all of a sudden England, and then they fight us. Wait a minute, you're stacking the deck against your own country. Why would you want to declare war on them? They declared war on us, the Germans, and 2 days after Pearl Harbor. I mean, why did they do it? How
Right.
could they possibly? They didn't have a navy really to compete with our navy. They couldn't take us on. They couldn't taking on Russia was delusional. And the
Right.
people, not that the Russians, the Germans were good people at all. I'm not going to defend it because I'm studying it all the time. What were they thinking? But we bombed the hell out of them for 2 years after Stalingrad. They never quit. That's something else you got to wonder about. Bombing countries, bombing Vietnamese, the VC, nobody quits. The British didn't quit when they were bombed. The Germans
So,
didn't quit. And by the way, the Iranians are not going to quit because we bombed them. Can't you get a little history in your head, Trump? Bombing doesn't get people to put the white flag up. They just don't do it.
no, yes, Vietnam's a perfect example. So I'll give
I
you the
teach
answer
there
to
every
my
year. I go there every year to teach. And
I'll give you the answer to my own question about presidential leadership. March 1965, right after the Selma to Montgomery march. The Alabama State Police beat the marchers, and LBJ went before a joint session of Congress and said, "We shall overcome," and demanded a voting rights bill. How
Richard
old were you?
Goodwin. Richard Goodwin wrote that speech.
How old were you in March 1965?
20.
20. Do you remember it then?
Not being 20, not quite 20. We shall overcome.
Right. I mean, it took a president to get out there in front of a national audience and embrace the words of the civil rights movement to move public opinion, obviously. And Reagan obviously had his moments.
I forgot Kennedy's great the speech in June of 63. I should have said that one, but he and Bobby decided after watching the hell that went on in Birmingham, all the young kids, those cute young kids, 15-year-old kids getting hosed and everything by the police, Bull Connor and all that horrible stuff. And he went on TV that night and said, "It's as old as the scriptures, as American as the Constitution. We have to be for civil rights." It was just, and that's when Martin Luther King said he hit that ball, that white guy, he said, just hit the ball out of the park. And where did that come from? It came from Bobby largely, who had the heart. But where'd that come from? These guys are Irish pals from New York and from Massachusetts, but where did that heart come from? I mean, they weren't super liberals in that sense, but they weren't like Hubert Humphrey or somebody. But where did they come from? It was magical, that speech. And Johnson's was, and he was certainly not a perfect kind of guy. He used bad language about race. Of course, we know that. We can study history. That's the way he was brought up. But he gave it, and he got it done. And
Yeah.
it was those were moments. I wish I thought of them as you did. Those are great. Where'd that come from, kind of thing? Like, I didn't know I was that great to give that speech.
Okay. Any closing words of wisdom to the American voter who is listening to this interview, to be optimistic? Why should we be optimistic about the
Okay, I'll give you
future?
one because I've been working on this for weeks. Okay, not
Okay.
for your program, but I grew up right near Washington's Crossing, where George Washington took our troops, our ragtag troops across the ice, and they brought 18 cannon with them. and 50 horses. I mean, it was not, it's not like that. But look, that German guy's painting of the guy standing up in the boat. It was not like that. The boats were
Right.
twice that size. They had 30-foot oars. I mean, imagine pulling a 30-foot oar. I mean, it's, and they did it in this horrible weather. And then they marched for 9 miles down the Trent. And the two other outfits that were going to cross the river that night didn't make it because the ice was too bad. They turned back. So what Ashton did, he went in alone. He went in there with these troops that hadn't won a battle forever. They lost New York, they lost in Manhattan, they lost in Brooklyn, they lost in Fort Lee. They lost nothing but every battle. And he took them across that in the middle of the night. He had, first time we used wristwatches. Washington checked his watch at 5:30 Christmas night, said, "We're going off. We're leading and heading across the river." And then at midnight, they start to moving down the 9 mile walk, some of them with no shoes on ice, barefoot. So they get there, and because they brought the cannons, because one guy says, our powder's getting wet. He said, "Well, use your bayonet." This is what the officer said, "Use your bayonet. This is for real." And Washington had written on a note down, "Victory or death." He had written them to himself. That was his password to himself. Victory or death. He knew he had to win this battle. And the Colonel Rall, the Hessian guy, the less paid for army. By the way, in the Declaration of Independence, we attacked the Brits for using Hessians, for using farm power, paid workers, paid mercenaries. We won the battle. 900 prisoners we put across the river to Pennsylvania, marched them through the streets of Philadelphia. We took six of their cannon. We took their supplies, some of the booze stuff that they took. And then a couple of days later, we won the Battle of Princeton. Again, Washington went around Cornwallis and went through his rear and defeated and won the Battle of Princeton. This leader, where did we find this guy from? You know, where did he come from, Washington? And I know he had slaves, and I didn't say he was a perfect man, but as a general, where did he come from? You know, and it's like, I always wonder about all the great musicians were in the 20s, you know, the Tin Pan Alley. Why did Gershwin and all these guys and Coleport, all these, they all came together for a couple of years, and they just happened to be there. And the founding fathers just happened to be there. And but Washington, you know, he was a gutsy guy who took chances. And he had the guts to, he always moved with his outfit. He'd be right out there getting shot at. He did. Washington would be leading the troops. It's a 6'3" guy, march, riding with his troops, saying, "Let's keep, stick with your officers. Let's keep it going here. Let's, you know," it's magical. I'm thrilled by it. I just thinking about, we got the 250th anniversary of our country, the 250th anniversary of crossing the Delaware in December this year. We had heroes. We don't have one now. There's nobody in the Senate who today can walk on the floor of the Senate and tell Trump he's take him on, take him on. And that, by the way, is part of the language you use today. Take him on, and nobody's doing it. There's no Ted Kennedy. There's no John McCain. There's no Mitt Romney. Where's the gutsy person to just say, "Look, I know this is going to get me a primary next year, but the hell with it. I don't think this president has any brains. And why are we in a war we didn't want to be in?" And by the way, this is the first war we've ever gotten into where there's no cheering. Remember
Right.
that scene in Gone with the Wind, where all these Southern rebs and they're all dressed up, rich guys dance. When they announced the war, they're all cheering and they were so happy they're going to war against the militarized industrial North that they were going to lose to. But they were going to go to war. This war starts out with a thud. Nobody is cheering.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Today, John Bolton has an article in the paper today. The real neocons—they're out there. They're just—they love this. Is their big comeback opportunity. The ones that took us to Iraq. I'm sorry. I've been against the Iraq war. I'm against this war. I was against the Gulf War. I'm consistent. Don't go into the Middle East starting fights because you're going to end up losing. We don't belong there. I'm sorry. We don't belong in this fight. Israel has a good case. They have a good case. Because they could pop them once in Tel Aviv, and that's horrendous. They have to make this fight. But that doesn't mean we have to make the fight. We're an ally of Israel. We're not their protector. We're their ally. That's a different situation. And we should look to our other allies and what they want. That's a
All
thought.
right. Well, I'm our listeners can't see you, but I can. And right behind you over your left shoulder is a Barack Obama poster with the words hope. So I want to leave this interview on a note of hope.
Just
I believe
remember,
in
I was the guy that said right after he gave that incredible speech in Boston in 2004, I was on TV then as anchor of Hardball, and I said, "You've just seen the first African American president." Right then, I said it right then. And then Michelle, according to her book, would rag him around the house and say, "All right, Mr. President," sarcastically.
I think I was a witness to when you said that. Okay. Chris Matthews, thank you very much for your time and your wisdom.
I think
And
it's wisdom. I think it's wisdom.
I'll see you on when you invite me back to your next
I
Substack.
like your office. It's very well appointed. It's a well-appointed office. It's very nice.
Thank you.
Thank
Thank
you
you.
very much, sir. Thank you.
All right. Have a good day.